Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell was first elected in 2011. He's won re-election five times since. A lot has changed in the Wailing City over the last 13 years, and today we welcome Mayor Mitchell back to The Point to talk all things New Bedford. Good to see you. It's been a while.
Good to see you. It has been a while.
Exactly. And if you have questions this morning, 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So let's start right off the bat with offshore wind. The Port of New Bedford poised for the development of the offshore wind industry. Before we look at what might be coming, tell us where we're at right now in those efforts, because I know you've been working hard on this for a while.
Yeah, we've been working hard on it because we see New Bedford as having certain advantages in relation to that industry. We're already a very successful, the most successful fishing port in the country, and we have all sorts of new infrastructure that we've been able to build to support all sorts of maritime industries. And we have, we're close to the wind. Bedford's the closest port to what is, I think, what people generally consider to be the center mass of the wind areas on the East Coast. So with all these advantages, we see this as, well, we've seen it as an opportunity to attract capital to the city and extension jobs and other activities. So that's the theory of action. And right now we're at a point where we are about three quarters of the way through the Vineyard Wind project, which is America's first major offshore wind project. Yeah. And that's has had some fits and starts along the way. But
it's also, too, I mean, like they're huge. And it's not just any port that would be able to support this, right? I mean, there's not a lot of places that you'd be able to have this kind of infrastructure.
Yeah, on the East Coast. Yeah, unlike Northern Europe, much of the East Coast of the U.S. is privately owned. I mean, look here in Woods Hole and Falmouth. Most of the shoreline is privately owned. And so as you go down the coast, New Bedford's one of the few places where you have major industrial activity going on the water. And so we've been able to marshal a fair amount of both public and private resources to open up still more land, and so that's why we're able to accommodate the industry pretty easily.
A working waterfront.
Yes.
All right, so given the Trump administration, will offshore wind continue to offer employment opportunities for New Bedford residents, and how many long-term New Bedford residents are actually benefiting from these jobs?
Well, so there's a number of things to unpack there. My guess as to what the Trump administration might do is as good as yours,
yeah.
Mindy. I just don't know how much his governing decisions are going to match up with the campaign rhetoric we heard. The campaign rhetoric was emphatically negative about offshore wind, but as you get into the details, and it's true also of immigration, right? Things are complicated. There are lots of folks who are now working on offshore in offshore wind. There are lots of union jobs in offshore wind, and the unions had sort of many unions had a fairly close role with the Trump campaign, and then there are a lot of major oil companies that have significant investments in offshore wind, and they're telling him, no, you kind of want to keep it. And so I think you're going to see, personally, my hunch, and it's a hunch, is that some projects will most projects that are underway will continue to be underway and will be completed. I think there'll be some retrenchment in some of the new wind areas that the Biden administration has identified on the East Coast, and who knows when those go forward. But by and large, I think the horse is out of the barn on offshore wind. It's going to continue to go forward.
Yeah, it would be a shame to sort of stop it now when it's almost, three quarters complete, right?
Yeah.
All right, thoughts on new wind areas in the Mid-Atlantic. There's an argument that they encroach on scallop and other fishing grounds. How can the city advocate for the fishing industry? Because, there's a...
Well, we do a lot of that.
Yeah.
So I've testified before Congress a number of times about fishing and before the fisheries councils and have made our voice known in a number of ways, because we're the largest commercial fishing port in the United States, it gives me a certain platform to talk about fishing issues. Our position has always been that offshore wind and commercial fishing on the East Coast of the United States can successfully coexist. But that means that the two sides have to talk to one another, and we certainly have tried to facilitate and officiate those conversations. And good science has to play a role in those decisions. There have been certain wind energy areas that have been identified by the federal government that, frankly, weren't done with a whole lot of analytical rigor, and the Mid-Atlantic was one of them. So what they did in determining where that area should go, they reached out to folks who fish from ports in Maryland, which there aren't that many big fishing ports in Maryland. And so those folks said, well, you know, we don't have a problem with a wind energy area that's somewhat close to the Maryland shore. Well, it turns out that there's a whole lot of fishing that goes on, but the fish are landed in New Bedford. They're not landed in Maryland ports. And so the federal government, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, didn't talk to folks here. And so when they drew the map and said, this is where we want to put offshore wind farms off of Maryland, well, it turns out, yeah, there's millions and millions of dollars worth of scallops that go to the port of New Bedford. So we have a problem with it. Surprise, surprise. So it turns out that if the Trump administration says, yeah, you guys are right, that you, New Bedford, are right, there shouldn't be a wind energy area there, then that's consistent with our interests. Mm-hmm. What we do think is that certain established wind farms that are not in areas where fishermen are likely to fish or in sensitive habitat areas, those should continue to go forward. And the Vineyard Wind Project is one of them, and as well as, frankly, all the projects off of Massachusetts. Those are not heavily fished areas. I mean, there are some fishermen who are affected, but by and large, that is not a jackpot area for commercial fishing.
All right. So you just sort of touched on this, but concerns for the immigrant population under the Trump administration. I know there's a lot of concern in New Bedford about that.
There are in a number of our immigrant populations, and it's not just among folks from Central America, although that's the Central Americans in the city represent the largest new immigrant group, but it also includes a whole lot of Afghans. We were fairly deliberate in inviting Afghans, especially after the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan back in 2021, to come to New Bedford. And so now we have, I think our last estimate is that we have about 70 Afghans living in the city, and they attend the local mosque, and they're already working and contributing, and some of them are already buying houses. Their kids are in the school system. They are parolees, as that term is defined in federal immigration law, so they have a special status. But there's been some talk that status might be lifted, and so again, this is an area where the reality of the Trump administration's governing will come up against some of the campaign rhetoric. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine that any president is going to say, no, you people need to go back to the welcoming arms of the Taliban. Right? Mm-hmm. That's not realistic. I mentioned that as one example of where it's just unlikely that the campaign rhetoric can actually be implemented. There will be some people who will be deported. In fact, by most estimates, there are about 1.2 million folks living in the United States who are already subject to removal orders. It's kind of hard to argue that unless the law was misapplied, unless there's a good faith basis to say those removal orders are invalid, I mean, they probably should be removed. But what about everybody else? And so those removal actions beyond the ones that are subject to orders. It's kind of hard to believe that's going to happen on a mass scale.
Yeah, and I know that there's
and I've told people that it doesn't assuage all the fears.
Right. I was just going to say there's a lot of people nervous.
So we tell people, look, we at the local level are not going to be engaged in roundups of folks. Mm-hmm. We're not going to withhold information from federal law enforcement. We're really just continue to do our job the same way. And I think most cities are in that position. It's the immigration is such a hot topic, and it's so politically charged right now. And a lot of folks, I think there's a lot of talking past one another on the issue, unfortunately. Right. And as we know, Congress, it's been almost 30 years since Congress has done anything comprehensively about immigration in this country, which is really unfortunate, because I think there is a lot of agreement out there on some of the basics. And so for us in New Bedford, look, our position is we treat everybody decently. We're a welcoming city, and And we abide by the law. Yeah. It's quite that simple.
And I think I was reading that some of the nonprofits that are working with these communities are preparing and are trying to help some of these folks and give them some of the realities. Like you say, some of it's fear that may not move forward, but you can understand how they'd be fearful. So
they are, and we've had a number of discussions with them, and I think they feel they trust the immigrant communities. I'd like to believe trust the police in our city. Our police are very we have a very professional and successful police department in New Bedford, and they have been very active in having those kinds of discussions with some of the immigrant support groups. But everybody's just waiting to see what's going to happen.
I'm wondering how it is now. I know the police department's always been like that, right? They've always been very welcoming and trying to build relationships with immigrant communities. The former sheriff, there was a sort of conflict there. How is that now with a different sheriff? Are they mirroring each other's efforts with the police department and the sheriff's office, or not so much?
I actually don't think the sheriff's office have a whole lot of authority as it is in Massachusetts, but it doesn't stop sheriffs from talking as though they have a whole lot of authority. And so over the years, we heard a whole lot of rhetoric about immigrants from the sheriff's office, even though the sheriff's office didn't play a major role in immigration enforcement. Yeah. But.
Right. All right, let's move on to South Coast Rail.
South Coast Rail for 400. Okay.
Whoa. All right. So when is it set to open? Right. And how do you see it benefiting the community? I mean, there's always pros and cons to everything. You know, are there concerns that it will accelerate the cost of housing? I mean, what are your thoughts on rail and?
In general, the intercity rail project to Boston between New Bedford and Boston is a good thing for New Bedford. It gives people. It's one more reason to live in the New Bedford area. If you can get on a train and go to Boston and miss the traffic, that's great. I would say the same thing about a whole lot of other transportation options as well. I mean, over the last several years been building out our airport much more fulsomely and replacing the runways and doing the same thing with our terminal and all that. So I see South Coast Wind in that same. That's from that same perspective. If we can get people from New Bedford to other cities, great, without hassle. The rhetoric around South Coast Rail, we're talking about rhetoric a lot these days and versus reality. I think the reality of the rail connection is that it's a good thing, but it is not nearly the big deal it has been portrayed over the years to be. It'll be a 95-minute train ride, right? Mm-hmm. And so it is not a commuter option in the traditional connotation of the word commuter. People aren't going to take it 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year over the course of a career. At least very, very, very few people will. But in an age where remote work is a real option for many, much of the workforce, it's an option to go to Boston a couple of days a week, maybe once a week, without having to drive, and that's a good thing. As far as the housing market goes. I think there's been some speculative investments in relation to the rail, but that's not really what's driving housing prices in the city.
But it seems like such a long time coming, though, huh? How long have we been talking about rail?
Well, we've been talking. The region's been talking about it for a long time, and when I got into office, I made clear that there's a lot more to talk about under the general topic of economic development than a very long rail link between New Bedford and Boston. And I think. There hadn't been beforehand a real economic development strategy that was grounded in New Bedford's organic economic advantages.
Yeah,
the port, the cultural sector, the manufacturing sector, the healthcare. Say these things. That's the work we've been doing. And so, I've certainly been an advocate for that rail line, but I've never seen it as sort of. You know, the primary economic development initiative in the city.
When is it set to open?
May.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll be on it. I think you'll see a lot of folks jumping on it for the novelty of it.
Oh,
And then there'll be a normalized volume of passengers thereafter at some point. And
Yeah, hop on it to go, you know, go to Boston for a Red Sox game or an event or something like that. Better than I'd rather take the train than drive.
You could, right? But it's just not really, you're really not going to commute.
No, but for fun, right?
Oh, yeah, for fun. We should call it the fun rail, Mindy.
Exactly. We're talking with New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell this morning. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're sitting down with New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell this morning. If you have a question about New Bedford, we'd love to hear from you. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Sort of touched on housing. Affordable housing, of course, a concern across the region. There are concerns housing is being bought and developed by large companies not based in New Bedford who are inflating prices and profits and are leaving the community. Are you seeing evidence of that happening?
Not really. Well, and let me be specific about what I mean. So over the last few years, and a little bit less maybe in the last year or so, there was a trend across the country for private equity and other well-capitalized entities to go out and buy up housing across the United States. And I think that slowed up a little bit. But that's not what we're seeing in New Bedford. We've seen a little bit of that. We do see absentee ownership of mostly tenement housing in the city, right? So the traditional mm-hmm. the three families that you see in New England cities all over. And so the owner occupancy rate of three-family housing in New Bedford is it's actually come up over the last few years, but it's a little under it's about 40% right mm-hmm. now, which is up actually fairly significantly over the last few years. So but we have, as I noted earlier, we have seen some folks, not major corporations, but outside investors come in and buy housing, rental housing, including tenements, at prices that are greatly above what where the market was even a couple of years ago. And so I think some of that is speculative. And look, when that happens, obviously it makes it harder for people A to buy or B to rent. And the rents, mm-hmm. the cost of those purchases are obviously passed on to renters, and so it is made it harder. It's made the housing market tighter for mm-hmm. sure. But that's a story that's playing out across the United States, yeah. right? So that's not, and the fundamental reasons for it are many, but a lot of it just has to do with inefficient land use across the country, suburban zoning, and similar barriers to using land more efficiently.
Yeah. One of the things we know, and we talk about affordable housing a lot, and you know, it was, I'm saying maybe a decade ago, you know, the islands started to go up in price, right? And people left the islands and they're coming to the Cape. And then now the prices in the Cape have gone up and the people on the Cape are, and a lot of the housing assistance folks can't find, you know, affordable rentals. There's very few, as we know, in this region, and they're sending them to New Bedford. So the rental rates in New Bedford go up because of that. Not quite as high as the Cape right now, but right. Does that concern you as you see, you know, that kind of flux of people moving in to New Bedford from other areas, like even maybe even the Boston area, where the rents are just outrageous.
Yeah, we're not seeing a whole lot of folks from the Boston area. It's just too far away. I mean, we're 60 miles from Boston. But there is some data that I think pretty clearly indicates that there are some folks from the Cape, some mm-hmm. folks from northern Bristol County, and some folks from closer to Rhode Island who've moved from places that from those places to New Bedford because they can't afford to live in those places anymore. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's a problem. And look, I mean, New Bedford's just not in a position to accommodate all of that. You can't, in the long run, you can't accommodate those kinds of migration trends unless you're growing jobs just as fast at a very simple level. So although we are certainly growing economically and the job, the employment base in the city has been growing for a while, it's not growing at nearly the rate of the influx of folks coming into the city. So that leaves a very tight housing market. It's not gentrification. I think mm-hmm. a lot of folks in the city characterize it that way, and they see At once, a tighter housing market, and secondly, just a nicer place to live. And Bedford's just physically improved over the last several years. It's more in the way of a lot of folks at lower price points coming in the city, displacing people who are at still lower price points.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, like, you know, the one great thing about New Bedford is diversity, right? You talked about this. I mean, you welcome everybody. And when you look at the Cape, which is very white, and then you look at the New Bedford area, which has got such diverse and such great little neighborhoods, are you seeing changes in these neighborhoods, you know, with this influx of other people, or is it still keeping some of that character?
Well, I mean, so New Bedford's a city. It's not, and it's a city that sits on its own bottom. It's the center city of its region. And like similarly situated cities, it has a certain DNA that is reflected in its culture. And I think in our case, it's a place that's tied to the sea, that is very tolerant, and just sort of quirky in all the best ways. Like other cities, as in other cities, neighborhoods evolve over time. Some evolve faster than others. And we see, you know, in our case, we do see new immigrant groups come in. It is the city is more Spanish-speaking right now. So by the numbers, by the 2020 census, in particular, New Bedford, 61% white, 39% non-white. The non-white population is primarily Hispanic, just generally speaking, but that's as we know, the term Hispanic is sort of very broad brush, right? That there are many groups that fall within that category. In our case, many Central Americans as well as Puerto Ricans and such, but we're also there are other groups in the city as well. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, we have a growing Afghan population, and we're very proud that we're taking care of those people who took care of Americans in combat, and they're working. Many of them are working at one of the city's largest defense contractors, which is sort of poetic in a certain way. But they're also settling in well, and I'm just looking forward to the first Afghan restaurant in the city. We're not quite there yet, but yeah. I say all that because it's the city is my job is to make things somewhat stable, right? Mm-hmm. But also to keep things interesting. And I think we've been able to achieve both of those aims.
You have a question for Mayor Mitchell? 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. What's the status of the Star Store building?
Well, the Star Store building has been... it hasn't been taken. We have pursued it in land court and as part of a tax taking. And it's now that it's empty, it is behind on its taxes. And so we've taken that step so we could have greater control over its future. We've been talking to a number of entities that have sort of an arts related mission to see to gauge interest in reconstituting that some kind of arts institution there. It was unfortunate that the University of Massachusetts abruptly shuttered the place. I think it was an important presence in the downtown art scene. It wasn't sort of a primary driver of the local economy. I think some of that's been overstated, but it is an important institution in the city. It was, and so we think that there may be some opportunities to build something new there that's just as good.
And the arts community in New Bedford is really vibrant. I don't know if a lot of people realize that, but there's a lot going on.
You do, Mindy. You realize it.
Well, we have them on the show a lot of the artists, but there's a lot going on.
There's a ton going on. So just by the numbers, right? So we have significant arts institutions. There's the Zeiterion Performing Arts Center, which is undergoing a $37 million renovation now that we've been heavily involved in. The Whaling Museum is expanding. The Bedford Art Museum is expanding. All to the good. It's all very – so those are the downtown arts anchor institutions. But at the same time, we have a very vibrant and have for a long time have had a very vibrant working artists scene. And look, arts as a urban regeneration or development strategy, arts has long been in vogue, right? It's always like, well, you got to have an art scene to be, you know, a hip city and to attract younger folks and all that. Well, in New Bedford, It's always been there. It isn't the art scene is pervasive, and it hasn't been something that we've tried to superimpose on the city. It goes the arts. New Bedford's been this artsy place that going all the way back to the height of the whaling industry in the mid 19th century. So we've certainly cultivated those crops and have done things like we established the first dedicated arts fund in Massachusetts. We carve out a portion of our hotel tax receipts and have created to seed the fund, to fund it every year. And what that does is it's allowed us to formulate the city's first cultural plan. We have an arts director, and it also allows us to do a whole lot of grant making with working artists. So we do a lot of public art. It's pretty cool stuff. But we also have a whole lot of artist lofts. And because the housing, compared to much of the rest of Northeast, is fairly affordable, it's a place where artists can set up shop, because most working artists consider themselves to be small businessmen and women, and they New Bedford's a place where they can afford to live, they can afford to work, and ply their trade and be welcomed in doing that.
Mm-hmm. Arts economy is a lot bigger than I think people realize. How much does the art community contribute to the economy?
It's always hard to pin that down. There are a few things that we do know. So we do know that, Richard Florida, who's one of the leading observers of the urban scene in the United States, 10 years ago did a survey for The Atlantic in which he sought to rank the most artistic, this is his word, artistic cities in the United States. And New Bedford was seventh in his ranking, and it was really just a ranking of the per capita number of working artists in the place. But you know, in a city of 100,000, most of the other places that were ranked were much smaller,
places.
Right? So it's a lot. So there's a lot of people working there. We also know that a lot of folks who come and stay in our hotels are there in part to go out to shows at the Zeiterion Theater, to go to the Whaling Museum, to go to the New Bedford Art Museum, and some of these other places. We established yet another theater next to City Hall and the First Unitarian Church, which is best known as the place where Robert's Rules of Order originated. So that's kind of a cool thing. So they have a run of performances that straight through the year. So we've added yet another theater, which is kind of cool, just in recent years. So there's a lot of that is happening. It's hard to quantify it. We've done some studies that suggest that it's fairly significant. It's tens of millions of dollars to the local economy, but I think it's even bigger than that.
Yeah, like Aha Night, right? And you get like
Aha Nights. That's really cool. And then lots of festivals, lots of placemaking. We do lots of live. We promote live music. We want people to feel like there's always something going on.
Yeah. You mentioned Zeiterion, not a city project, but Zeiterion, of course, culturally important. For anybody who hasn't been, it's a beautiful theater, right? And that's a year-round, always something going on there.
Well, there is, yeah. The Z, for those who aren't familiar with it, is a vaudeville-era theater that is really sort of uniquely decorated and designed. It's a fairly compelling place, and you walk in and it feels like 1924. Mm-hmm. It is the central performing arts center for our entire region, and it's also a driver of the downtown economy. When on nights of Z shows, it is very hard to get a table at a restaurant, and so right now the Z is undergoing a major renovation, a $37 million renovation. We, the city, have put in about a little over $7 million into a lot of that federal ARPA funds. And it's also, but what that'll do is it'll expand the seating so that it'll generate, the place will generate more revenue. But they're also, you know, creating other spaces, an educational center, a speakeasy, Mindy.
So if you think, thinking
Prohibition era, you know.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So that'll be done in about a year, and they're going to put a big marquee out front. Call it a grand marquee.
Oh, okay.
Like the car, right? It's a joke. Sorry. Yeah. And so that'll be a big big new future for the Z. But people, but they've first rate shows.
Absolutely. They get big name people in there.
Big name
sure.
people come.
With UMass leaving downtown, what's been the impact there?
Well, I think some of the retailers nearby have felt a drop in sales. I think that, but at the end of the day, it's really about having an anchor higher ed anchor institution in the downtown for us, and what that means for sort of the connection to the university and such. I think it was a very poor decision on the part of UMass Dartmouth and the UMass system to just pull up their tent pegs abruptly and call me up and just say it's done, to present me with a fait accompli without an opportunity to do something about it. I think it was just very, very irresponsible. But be that as it may, we have in place, we've been talking to a number of organizations that I think at the end of the day will leave the place in better shape and actually a stronger driver of economic activity.
So on the flip side, opportunity. There's opportunity.
There's always opportunity, Mindy. You can't do my job if you're not an optimist.
Yeah.
I am optimistic about it.
We're talking with New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell this morning. If you have a question or you'd like to make a comment about New Bedford, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. There are some other empty storefronts in downtown, certainly some impacts from the pandemic as small businesses closed. Are there ways for the city to help get more storefronts back there and open and thriving?
Yes. So I think what you, so the vacancy rate is downtown is not, well, it didn't change all that much during the pandemic. But we always look for ways to improve our retail scene at a time when retail in America is undergoing some fundamental and revolutionary changes, right? We're reminded of that this time of year when Amazon packages arrive at our doorsteps, right? That's the way that many of us shop these days. So what we do, what we've done is we've done everything we can to lower the barriers to success for our small businesses, and including small retailers. And so we used a lot of pandemic funds to do a number of things recently that were novel. So coming out of the pandemic, we, with our federal ARPA funds, we set up some loan programs for small businesses and grant programs to give them some working capital to sort of bridge very slow sales periods. So if they have some money to sort of at least keep things going, to pay the bills, to ensure their payroll is set. I think that's the feedback that we've gotten is helped. So we started a couple of those types of programs. We also started what in effect through our Economic Development Council, what in effect is a sort of an angel fund for small businesses, including restaurants, to sort of give them some seed capital, help them with their business plans. A lot of people go into business with great ideas, with terrific concept, but they don't know how to put their first foot forward with a business plan, much less.
And sometimes it takes a while before you can make money, right? I mean, it doesn't usually.
It does. So we've done a lot of that. We used a lot of pandemic relief funds for things like new storefronts. We had a very generous program for small business owners to fix up their storefronts. We gave them up to $40,000, a 75% match for their investments in their storefront, up to $40,000. And we did, I don't know, I think it was about almost 80 storefronts across the city.
Wow.
A lot. And so there's been a lot of sort of cosmetic upgrades to small businesses all over the place, which is pretty cool to see. Actually, I think it was a very useful investment for us. So that's worked out really well. And then, you know, look, we promote small businesses constantly. You have to, as mayor, I have to be a cheerleader for that stuff. Yeah. And I tell people, I've said this on TV. I've said this in a number of fora. I've said, look, I challenge you this Christmas, go out and shop local. Go to small businesses. Go to places. You will see that you can buy certain things from those places that you can't get on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
That not all small businesses are connected up to the Amazon mothership. There are plenty of them that are out there doing some that sell some pretty cool stuff that you won't find on Amazon. And then guess what? When you spend money with them, you're supporting somebody who actually is connected to the place where you live and who stands behind his or her product, and that's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, so shopping local has huge impact, right?
Yes.
You're always looking at economic development as the mayor, right? So talk a little bit about the picture. Now, we said a lot has changed over the last 13 years or so that you've been in office. Looking ahead, like as you're looking at economic development, where do you see New Bedford going?
Yeah, I think it's so we're on a trajectory right now that I think is if we can keep it going, we will avoid what older industrial cities like New Bedford have experienced over the last century, which are these huge swings in employment and unemployment and tax revenue, and we've seen it again and again over. We saw it over and over again over the years, where unemployment rate swings 10 percentage points in a matter of a couple of years, depending on the overall state of the American economy. Now, we want to be on a sort of a steady upward trajectory over time, and we do it. I mean, the discussions around economic development are often infected with gimmicks and easy fixes, but the reality is you build a local economy by playing to your strengths. Mm-hmm. It's like the song goes, accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative. But I don't mean that in just sort of a cheery way. You look at what you have, at the cards that you have, and you build economic clusters around them. So we have a lot of that already. We're best known as a port. Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing with respect to offshore wind is a perfect example of the approach. We're this big fishing port that has infrastructure. People go to sea. Right, proximity to natural resources, and so offshore wind made sense for us. So we've invested heavily in infrastructure, heavily in workforce development to build around what we already have, and it's working. Mm-hmm. Same thing goes with the art sector. Same thing goes with our manufacturing sector. We're building out a second industrial park in the city on our municipal golf course that we think will allow for considerable job and tax revenue growth. So we're playing to our strengths, and that's how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not an overnight exercise. Cities are built over many, many years.
Right.
But in our case, as a place where that's had its ups and downs historically, especially over the last century. Our goal is we know we've got to hustle more than other places, and that's what I preach all the time. Yeah, nobody's going to hand stuff to New Bedford, Massachusetts. We have to go out and get it, and that's right. What we do.
Yeah, you touched on the fishing industry. How healthy is it? Tell us a little bit what's going on in the fishing industry. It's challenging to be in the fishing industry. It's a hard job.
Yes.
Yes.
It is all those things, Mindy. Yes, it is a tough job done by tough people. And look, the commercial fishing has America's highest occupational mortality rate.
Yeah.
Just in my time in office, New Bedford's lost 10 fishermen.
Mm.
So it varies. Some boats have gone down. Other people have died at sea. But it is a dangerous job and really sort of a throwback to an era that in which workplaces were dangerous places, mm-hmm. right? It's just that we forget that in an age where, you know, of remote work and Zoom calls, right? So there's that overlay, and that sort of colors a lot of what our city is about. Now, I say all that, despite all that, New Bedford's the most successful fishing port in America, and it's the highest grossing fishing port. It is also it also has the largest cluster of fish processing in the United States, and it's been that way for a long time. We are sort of to fishing what Detroit is to automobiles, mm-hmm. or was, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it works well for us. It is vulnerable to a number of things, to climate change, to changes in the regulatory environment. Changes in the American diet to imports, right?
Mm-hmm.
So right now, Right now, there's a number of things going on, a number of interesting trends. Much of the East Coast fishing industry is consolidating in New Bedford because of its advantages of scale. Mm-hmm. You have all the sort of supporting businesses there, and you have an auction. They have a workforce, and so you have lots of boats that come up from the south to scallop during the scalloping season in New Bedford, not dissimilar from the way boats in like Seattle go up to Alaska during fishing season. You have that trend, which is, and we could talk about this for a while, but I just it leaves the industry somewhat vulnerable to changes in regulations, right? So if you see these, as we see other ports diminish up and down the East Coast, that constituencies for fishing also, the political constituencies right. for fishing also diminish. And so if you lose two senators, say, in North Carolina, well, that doesn't help an industry that is as heavily regulated as commercial fishing. Scalloping is still the mainstay, the cash crop for scallops are the mm-hmm. cash crop of New Bedford. And then that's being challenged now because there is been a drop in volume. There have been, at least in the last couple of years, and probably projecting out two years or so, there will be just fewer scallops out there to be caught. It looks like that'll work itself out a few years down the line as new scallops grow. These things are all monitored by NOAA. Scallop imports have risen, especially from Japan, in the last few years, and so that competition has put downward pressure on U.S. prices. I mention all this because it's complicated, mm-hmm. and we have what we try to do in New Bedford is to make sure they have the tools they need to continue to thrive. But we're also, that includes infrastructure and a whole lot else, but we also an advocacy for fair regulations. But at the same time, we are in the diversification game. That offshore wind, marine tech, and a number of other related marine industries are where we also want to go. We want to develop a more fully faceted marine cluster in New Bedford, and so that's the work we're in, Mindy.
Yeah. You mentioned climate change, and I'm wondering your thoughts. I mean, you got a working waterfront, a lot happening, and, you know, we're seeing sea level rise and the impacts of climate change. What is the city's plans when you're looking at resiliency or even, you know, some of the, there's a lot of historic preservation going on in New Bedford, and when you look at some of that historic structures that are on the water, that takes on a whole new challenge, right? So talk a little bit about how you're planning for climate change and the impacts.
Well, we have something called NB Resilient, which is the city's climate action plan, which our goal under that is to become carbon neutral by 2050. It's not it's similar to plans that other cities have. A lot of cities our size don't have those kinds of plans. So usually major cities have them, but we have them because dealing with climate change at both mitigating it and also adapting to it is very important to us. We've been the national leader in with respect to municipal solar and a whole lot of other energy efficient initiatives. And then obviously our work in offshore wind is a big part of that. When it comes to resilience, it's requiring us to think ahead. We look at the sea rise maps, including from right over here in Woods Hole. Right? A lot of work has been done here by both NOAA as well as HUI on the effects of rising sea levels. We look at that and our reaction, well, we got to build for the future. So mm-hmm. we have one of the most striking things about New Bedford these days is the modernization of our port. Mm-hmm. We're in the midst of about a $1.2 billion build-out of the port. It's the biggest build-out since New Bedford was the center of the whaling industry 150 years ago. And that build-out of the port, all the new piers that we've been building, have been informed by the risk of rising sea levels. So in other words, we're raising everything up mm-hmm. A couple of feet, which we think, we hope is sufficient, right?
Yeah.
But we're also doing a lot else. There's a lot of risk of coastal flooding and such that we have to deal with. So things as mundane as rebuilding pumping stations and, mm-hmm. and rebuilding our wastewater system. There's a whole lot of investment going on, and there will be for the foreseeable future. That's not gonna stop. And we also plan pretty intentionally for coastal hurricanes. New Bedford's paid the price over the decades with storm damage, and so we actively plan for that stuff.
And boy, oh boy, aren't you glad you got that hurricane barrier, right? And that, what would that cost to put in now? You know,
a lot. So right after Sandy, we had a number of cities in New York and New Jersey came to us, and they were like, well, it was all in the vein of, well, we'd like to have what you're having, right?
Cost a little bit more now.
A lot more. Yeah. $18 million in the 60s, and I'm sure well over a billion today if we built it today. Yeah.
The Melville statue and other beautification projects have a big impact on the city and residents, right? And a lot of people come there, tourists come there for the history, because there's a lot of history in New Bedford. So talk a little bit about, and are you seeing a lot of historic preservation happen? I mean, I know you are.
We promote it all the time.
Yes.
Look, it's New Bedford's got this curious story, right? So we live in an age where of everything sort of at our fingertips, right? We can, especially now, with just, you want to understand something, just sort of type it into the chat bot and you'll get an explanation. Might not be entirely accurate, but you'll get an explanation. What we have to offer is that, you know, New Bedford's not a New England mill town. It was a port built first and foremost of the port, and then later had textiles, right? But we are in other manufacturing, but it's a port, and it's a very unique port. It grew up on this very uniquely American industry. Yankee whaling was all about going out on the high seas and hunting the largest creatures with hand weapons, right? It was this sort of this fundamental audacity that was part and parcel of that industry that makes it all so interesting. Mm-hmm. And the stories that were told about that industry make it fascinating. And it was done at a scale without peer in New Bedford and out of New Bedford. And so, amplifying all of that is, of course, is Melville's opus, right? Moby Dick is generally considered to be the most famous work of literature in the Western world, and it's set in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Yeah. And yet we have not had, and I've always sort of scratched my head about this, like, why doesn't New Bedford have some major monument, some work of art dedicated to Melville? Why aren't we owning Melville?
Right.
We should own Melville, right? Melville was from Manhattan, and he wrote in Pittsfield, Mass, and so there are other places that purport to own him. And we have one street that's Herman Melville Boulevard. I've wondered this, and now, of course, I'm the mayor. I get to do something about it. So I said, we should have a major statue. So we put out a call for artists, and we had a number of really accomplished artists put in for it, including some who have works in a number of prominent public places, including Central Park. A number of European artists have contributed to it. I'm not prepared today to announce the winner, but we expect to announce a winner in the next few weeks.
Ooh, okay.
But that'll be a pretty cool thing.
Yeah.
Just
had about a minute left, but I just want to touch on, because I know a lot of people think of New Bedford and they think, oh, crime. But the crime rates actually come down.
Yes.
You talked about the police department, a good police department. But crime is not what it once was.
No, not nearly. So violent crime in New Bedford has dropped 58% in the last decade. And it has dropped across categories. Property crime has dropped 54%. It's one of the biggest drops in crime in the United States. And there are lots of reasons for it. There's never like one reason why crime would drop in any particular place. Some of it is just the improvement in the economy and improvement is sort of the built environment, national trends and such, the proliferation of cameras, right? That's a big contributing factor. But we also have a good police department, and that's they deserve credit for doing their work well, and we want to build on that. The perception's a lagging indicator. I think that some places people think that Bedford's still an unsafe place, but it isn't.
It isn't. All right. New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell, always good to see you.
Hopefully it
won't be as long before we have you back. Happy holidays to you.
Same to you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.